Hello, welcome to another episode of Steeped in History. Jimmy here, and I am solo today. It's only me, and I am currently recording this in my family home in North Wales on a little visit home. It's a beautiful day currently. I have a wonderful view of the mountains of Snowdonia out of the window just behind the laptop that I'm editing this podcast episode on. And I am currently drinking a cup of tea, as is traditional. I'm going to start the podcast by saying what kind of cup of tea I am drinking. And it will come as no surprise to some that I am drinking a cup of Clipper English breakfast tea. A little bit of milk, no sugar. I like Clipper tea. I think Clipper tea is really nice. They are one of the first companies that do unbleached home compostable tea bags, I believe. I tend to go for a loose leaf tea. I just prefer loose leaf tea. I think it tastes a bit nicer. But if I'm getting tea bags, I try and get tea bags that you can put in your compost at home, because I was absolutely appalled when I first learned that tea bags have plastic in them. I was absolutely appalled. I was just like, why do we need to put petrochemical products in everything? Why do they need to be in everything? It's ridiculous. You know, as somebody who does historical reenactment and spends a lot of his leisure time seeing how little you actually need plastic for, in a life as privileged as my own, of course, where I have a hobby and I have time to enjoy my hobby, I have enough money that I can buy tools and things that aren't made of plastic. But when you immerse yourself in history for long periods of time, you realise how little of our species' time on this planet has involved plastics. And then when you find out just how ubiquitous they are, it's really quite scary. But there we go. I am having a little cup of Clipper English breakfast tea, and very nice it is too. So, this episode, we are moving further back in time than my previous solo episodes. My solo episodes so far have been pretty darn recent, and this one we're going to move a little bit further back in time, which I think many of you will quite like. Now, of course, segment two of the podcast is the book segment. And I am shaking things up a little bit this time once again, because I'm not reading a history book this time. I'm actually not reading a non-fiction. I'm reading a fiction book at the moment, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And it's actually quite an old fiction book. It was first published in the 1840s. I believe it was actually first fully published in one in 1842, but it had been appearing in a magazine before then for a little while. Like a lot of things in the 19th century, like a lot of Dickens and Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes books appeared in magazines. I think they were in the Strand magazine. This book is called The Ingoldsby Legends. Ingoldsby, I-N-G-O-L-D-S-B-Y, The Ingoldsby Legends. And the author is a man called Thomas Ingoldsby, which was the pen name of a man called Richard Harris Barham, R.H. Barham. And the edition I've got is a little bit boring, because it says R.H. Barham on the spine instead of T. Ingoldsby, and I think that's a little bit of a... I think that's a little bit rude, really, but there we go. But the Ingoldsby Legends is basically a collection of short stories and poems. And I'll read you a little bit of the introduction says that the book is, "The world, according to the best geographers, is divided into Europe, Asia, Africa, America, and Romney Marsh," which is a bit of wetland in Kent and East Sussex in the southeast of England, and it's basically set there. And it's good fun. It's a fun collection of slightly silly short stories. Some of them are written in prose, some of them are written in verse. There are miniature plays in there, and this is actually a book that's been mentioned in a few places. It's mentioned in an H.G. Wells short story. Winston Churchill references it in his history of the Second World War, his massive history of the Second World War. Rudyard Kipling mentions it. P.G. Wodehouse talks about it in one of his stories. And the tragedy of it is this lovely little book, this great pastiche book by R.H. Barham, was kind of how he got his fame. And I think 3 years after it was published, he died. He was only 56 when he died. He was a bloke from Canterbury, Richard Harris Barham. B-A-R-H-A-M, Barham. Name I seem to struggle with a little bit. But he was a cleric. He was an English cleric. He went to Oxford, University of Oxford, Brasenose College, in case you're interested. And he was ordained, moved to Romney Marsh, and he published books. He wrote novels that didn't do very well. And eventually he became a canon at St. Paul's Cathedral and did quite well there for a little while and started publishing stories in magazines in the 1820s and 1830s. And he was quite poorly for quite a long time. He was quite ill for most of his life. And he died aged 56 in 1845. It was just 3 years, let me check, 3 years after this book was published in its entirety, which I think is really sad, because it's great fun, and I think this poor chap probably had quite a lot more to write and quite a lot more to contribute to the world of slightly zany, silly fiction. And I'm a big fan of things like P.G. Wodehouse and silly stories like that, that are all quite light-hearted, and you can just pick them up and put them down. You know you're not going to go on an Agatha Christie-style dark thriller ride full of blood and suspense. There's probably going to be a bit of a comedy of manners and a comedy of errors element to it, and then everybody's going to be fine at the end. That's the sort of thing that I quite like sometimes. And it's been a bit of a stressful period recently for I think, most of the northern and southern hemispheres of the world. So I am currently quite enjoying just reading the Ingoldsby legends and drinking my Clipper English breakfast tea. Thank you very much. Now, the next segment of the podcast, as ever, is the Year of Interest. And this episode's Year of Interest, I think, puzzled people a little bit. I put a picture up on my social media, on the YouTube and on the Instagram. And quite a few people had some guesses at what the picture related to. And the picture is actually Robert de Guiscard being crowned as Duke of Apulia and Calabria by Pope Nicholas II in 1059. And he was Duke of Apulia and Calabria in 1059. He was crowned by Pope Nicholas II. But the actual year of interest is the year 1042. I know, extremely naughty of me, and I'm sorry to have misled you in such a vile and dreadful fashion. But the reason it is 1042 and not 1059 is because 1042 is when William I of Hauteville, also known as William Iron Arm, which is one of the best medieval nicknames there is. He also had a brother whose name was Drogo, which is an excellent name. This is the year when William IV of Hauteville was recognized as supreme leader of the Normans in Italy, which is a very, very important thing for him to have been. And I find the Normans really, really fascinating. The Normans are an ethnic group of people from northern France, from Normandy. And they, of course, originally descend from Scandinavians. The Norman dynasty. They stem from a band under Rollo, who is effectively the first Duke of Normandy, or a fiefdom, really, at that point. Anyway, but Rolf, or Rollo, in the 9th century, comes to France and is given land by King Charles. I think it's King Charles III. I think it's Charles the Simple was his nickname, another unfortunate nickname. But basically, Rollo takes control of bits of northern France and converts to Christianity in order to enter into a treaty with King Charles, and expands the territory. And effectively, Normandy develops into a duchy. It develops into a proper medieval... the name of it's just completely fallen out of the side of my head. Does that ever happen when words just fall out the side of your head? Feudal. It develops into basically a medieval feudal system where we have the Dukes of Normandy, we have the Duchy of Normandy, and under them we have their various underlings, and then under them we have the peasantry, and we also have the priesthood, and it becomes extremely Catholic and very, very Christian. And over the next couple of centuries, bands of Normans travel south, probably because they hear pilgrims telling them about southern Italy, and much of which is under the control of Muslims. Eventually, Normans get to southern Italy in probably the first decade of the 11th century, so in the 1000s, 1010s at the latest. Normans arrive and start attacking the Muslims. The various stories include things like Guaimar III, the Lombard Prince of Salerno, basically, which is in Italy, mainland Italy, begs the Normans to stay in southern Italy and Sicily, but they refuse, and instead they say, well, we'll go home and we'll tell other people to come instead. William of Apulia says that Norman pilgrims went to Monte Gargano in 1016. Monte Gargano is a Roman Catholic shrine on Monte Gargano, which is an island, a mountain in Apulia. And they're persuaded to stave off Byzantine rule, so the Byzantine Empire has control of part of Italy as well. The kingdom, it's not actually a kingdom, the sort of segment of the empire in Italy is overthrown by the Normans, and the two big Norman families that go to the Mediterranean are the Drengo family, who were mercenaries in the service of the Lombards, who then become a very prominent family, and the family of Tancred of Hauteville, whose sons are William Iron Arm and Drogo, who end up there in 1038. And William Iron Arm and Drogo, the sons of Tancred of Hauteville, Seigneur d'Hauteville-la-Guichard, which is in Cotentin in Normandy, join a revolt against the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire at this point rules Apulia, sort of southeastern Italy, basically, borders the Adriatic Sea on one side, and sort of Strait of Otranto and Ionian Seas, I think. There might be more to it, but, you know, my Italian geography is not totally perfect. And by the early 1040s, the Byzantines have lost most of the province. In 1042, some Normans settle in Apulia permanently, and they choose the town of Melfi, M-E-L-F-I, Melfi, as their capital city, basically. They elect William as their count, so he is an elected count, so I guess kind of an electorate, like in the Holy Roman Empire, is happening here, right? And eventually his brother succeeds him, but William Iron Arm is elected as Count of Apulia and Calabria. And the title eventually becomes, in Latin, I'm going to read it in Latin, Comes Normannorum Totius Apuliae et Calabriae. The count, the Norman count of all Apulia and Calabrians. All Apulians and Calabrians, I think. So, William Ironarm doesn't last terribly long. William Ironarm actually dies in 1046. beg your pardon, I've got a little bit of a cough. He dies in 1046. He dies after a military campaign where he marches against Bari, which is where you get the ferry across to Patras in Greece. But Bari was still under Byzantine control. He tries to attack it. That doesn't go very well. He shifts his attacks elsewhere. He tries to attack Calabria and builds castles there. But it doesn't really work out, and he dies halfway through his campaign to try and expand Norman territory. But yeah, 1042, he is declared count. And it's interesting that in the 11th century, we hear about a lot of counts and a lot of dukes. Duke William, yeah, William of Normandy, Duke of Normandy. We have Count William of Apulia and Calabria elected as count. Don't hear about many kings, do we? And it's interesting, I think, that we see the Normans, or at least a lot of Brits see the Normans, a lot of British people see the Normans as this monolithic culture. Who were the Normans? They were the ones that invaded in 1066. And that's kind of all that we're taught about the Normans. But the Normans weren't just one monolith. In this period, there are Normans working for the Byzantine Empire. There are Normans working against the Byzantine Empire with the Lombards in Italy. There are Normans in Normandy who are working with the French crown. There are Normans who are fighting against the French crown. There are Normans who are fighting each other. These are mercenary bands, many of them. And although they have become much more French, they have French names, they speak Norman French, they're Catholics, they're Christians. There are bands of Normans in the first part of the 11th century who attack the papacy. everybody attacks the Pope at some point in European medieval history, don't worry about that, that doesn't make them special. But they are still, in a way, bands of mercenaries. And people very often say, under some of my videos in the comments, oh yeah, but the Normans were just Vikings, they were still just Vikings. And they weren't Vikings at all by 1066. But in the 1000s, 1010s, 1020s, 1030s, 1040s, some of how they operated was still an echo, a distant, fading echo, but an echo of their Viking origins, because they were still operating as military forces abroad. They were still using a lot of ships to get around. They were still doing a lot of sailing. They were still operating as mercenaries. They were still focused on getting silver in exchange for their services. But it's interesting that they elect William. He keeps the Normans under control. He's very, very good on the battlefield. He's a great leader. He's a strong leader. And he was nominated and elected as count of Apulia and Calabria, or in Apulia, I think, initially, and his title and his land were recognised by Guaimar IV. Remember Guaimar III? I think I'm pronouncing it right. I think it's Guaimar III. Prince Guaimar III, or Guamario. There are lots and lots and lots of ways of saying it and pronouncing it. Prince of Salerno, yeah? Well, Guaimar IV recognizes William as duke. He recognizes as count. He recognizes his territories. So, pretty darn important that an actual leader, an actual country's leader, recognizes you, because that has to happen for your feudal title to be legitimate. If you want a legitimate title, it has to be recognised. And Guaimar the Fourth gives his niece to William to marry, and gives him even more land. He gives him Ascoli, which is in Apulia. He gives him a town. He says, yeah, here you go. Not only this, here you go. Thanks for helping us get rid of the Byzantines. So William becomes a vassal of Guaimar the Fourth. Guaimar then becomes Duke of Apulia and Calabria. A duke is above a count, right? You have counties within a duchy. So the duke is above the count. So William Ironarm doesn't declare himself prince. He doesn't declare himself a king. He works his way up the ladder, the feudal ladder, which is not what we might expect, possibly, from a medieval leader. You might think these Normans, these powerful warriors, would want all of the land and all of the titles and immediately try to become kings. But the problem there is, A, Guaimar the Fourth is prince of Salerno. B, his duchy hasn't been recognized. So nobody has recognized... So a prince has recognized William as count. Nobody has recognized Prince Guaimar the Fourth as the legitimate Duke of Apulia and Calabria. That has not happened. Also, quite a lot of Muslim people are still in control of a lot of Sicily. So there's still an awful lot more fighting to be done before, you know, they can claim that they freed Italy and Sicily, which was kind of what they wanted to do. However, in 1047, the Holy Roman Emperor also claims the Duchy of Apulia and Calabria. Once again, if you've ever played the video game Crusader Kings 3, you will know that people claim titles all the time in medieval Europe for lots of different reasons. They claim the title so that they can declare war on a neighbour. They claim a title so that they can do a land grab. They claim a title so that they can form an alliance with somebody else. There are so many reasons you would claim a title. In 1059, all of that is settled. The county is officially named the Duchy of Apulia and Calabria, Ducato di Puglia e Calabria, and Robert Guiscard, who is Robert d'Hauteville, so he is a member of the Hauteville family, sixth son of Tancred. So this guy's kids have been duking it, literally duking it out, hey, get it, in southern Italy for 20 years at this point. Robert Guiscard is named Duke by Pope Nicholas II. So, Pope Nicholas II is what is referred to as a universal power, right? Spiritual, supreme leadership of the world. Dominium mundi, control of the universe. Dominium mundi. If you are recognized by the Pope or the Holy Roman Emperor, you can pretty much pick one of the two. If you choose the Emperor, then the papacy will not be happy with you. Bear that in mind. But pro tips, if you want to claim a medieval title or to start a medieval title up, it has to be recognized by one of them. Just a pro tip. I'd go with the papacy. Lasts longer. But after a few more years, in 1077, Salerno, Guaimar, the Prince of Salerno. Salerno is conquered in 1077 by the Normans, and they add it to the Duchy of Apulia and Calabria, and then the Normans conquer, by doing so, they conquer southern Italy, right? Except Naples. 1078, they move the capital from Melfi to Salerno, and they start focusing on Sicily, and eventually they sort of salami conquest Sicily until in 1091 they've basically managed it. But the kingdom of Sicily isn't founded until 1130. Now the kingdom of Sicily is a Norman kingdom. Sicily itself is conquered by 1091, but it takes another 39 years. There's papal agreement here. Why? Because we are creating a new kingdom. There isn't a kingdom of Sicily before this, and so Roger of Sicily, Roger the Great, has to get the agreement of Pope Innocent II to create the kingdom of Sicily and to become the king of Sicily. Roger the First, his dad, was de facto king of Sicily, but on Christmas Day 1130, the Normans control all of Sicily and southern Italy and stay there for another 60-odd years. It's then conquered by one of the Holy Roman Empire's families, the Hohenstaufen family, in the 1260s. It is then conquered by the Angevin, because they're from Anjou, I believe, family, Anjou, the Angevin dynasty. Then it's under Spanish control, Aragonese and Spanish control, for about 500 years until the 18th century. So all of this half of, not even half of Italy, like a third of Italy and the island that the boot's given a kick to, all starts with William Iron Arm being, well, it doesn't even start with William, it starts with Tancred, but it's Norman rule kind of starts with William Iron Arm, a Norman adventurer, a mercenary, part of a noble house, made noble through conquest, and trundling over there, possibly because pilgrims told him to, possibly because he was on his way back from a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And, effectively, the Hauteville family, Tancred's family, was too big. So Tancred of Hauteville basically said, look, I haven't got enough room for all my kids. Some of you need to sod off to Italy and find some room. And so they did. They bimbled off in the 1030s and joined the rebellion against the Byzantines. The Lombards under the Guaimars are also quite interesting because they are kind of desperately trying to free themselves from the Norman yoke, from the Byzantine yoke, I beg your pardon, for quite a little while. The Lombards have obviously been in Italy for hundreds of years at this point, and they're trying to get rid of the Byzantine Empire in Italy. The Byzantine Empire in Italy, it has been there also for hundreds of years. But there are lots of fights, there are lots of rebellions, the Italians don't want to be ruled from Constantinople anymore, basically. They don't want to have kind of Norman puppets. They don't want to have Byzantine puppets in charge of them anymore. And so they happily accept help from the Normans. It's a hugely complex situation. There are assassinations, there are rebellions, there are reversals of treaties. It's a really, really fascinating period in Italian history. All the while, the popes are trying to secure their powers. Papal reforms are going on. The papacy is coming out of the Seculum Obscurum, this dark century of corrupt popes and popes selling the papacy and families being, the families of popes, effectively. Like, somebody's son becomes pope, and then their grandson becomes pope, and then their second cousin becomes pope. And I've just done a video on it on the YouTube channel. If you are interested in that, go check it out. It's a really, really interesting time, because we kind of think of Italy as fairly settled in many ways, right? Oh yeah, Italy was some different countries, then it was a kingdom, and now it's Italy. But Italy in the medieval period is this absolute hotbed of principalities and kingdoms and duchies and counties, all of which have their own fascinating leaders, all of which have their own really violent, long histories of rebellion against the Byzantine Empire, of rebellion against the Holy Roman Empire, of rebellion and anger against the papacy, of defending against France, of defending against incursions from the Islamic caliphates of North Africa. All this kind of stuff is going on for absolute centuries. It becomes a staging post during the Crusades. Venice becomes a small city that becomes a European superpower of trade and mercantilism. The Papal States are a chunk of the peninsula for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before they're stripped away in the sort of 18th, 19th centuries. So I find Italy absolutely fascinating, as you may have guessed. The Normans I find absolutely fascinating, these French-speaking mercenary bands who conquer southern Italy, Sicily, England, and it's incredible what these people do. They go over to Ireland, they build castles all over the place, and they start off as a little gang of Vikings who are given some land, a sack of cash, and told to convert, and at no point are they a country. At no point are they a kingdom. There is never a kingdom of Normandy, right? And there's never a single supreme Norman leader. William of Hauteville is supreme leader of the Normans in Apulia and Calabria. He is supreme Norman leader of a bit of Italy and a bit of Sicily by the time he dies. But there's never an emperor of the Normans. And that's really interesting, and it makes you wonder about their psychology. Are they just not built for that? Is this another fading echo of their Viking past, where they're small raiding groups? They're not really built for empire building. They're built for maritime raids on a small scale, getting some silver and having a little bit of land. Is it just not what they want? Do they recognize that their strength lies in being a flexible military force? Is it that they're just playing a really long game instead? Because they're very tactical, right? Like, William is very tactical. William the Bastard is very tactical in the way that he conquers England. He gets papal support. He makes agreements with the Pope to impose Roman Catholicism on the English Church. Gets money, gets a papal banner, all this kind of stuff. Like, William of Hauteville is being very tactical. He makes friends with Guaimar III. He accepts his niece in marriage. He is happy as a count. He tries to do a little bit of expansion, but it's only really solidifying his borders. And it takes generations. The Normans are this really good generational dynasty, right? They're a dynastic people. They recognize in some way, I think, that I might not conquer southern Italy and Sicily. My sons might not do it, but my grandsons might do it. Or my great-grandsons might do it. And by then, we'll be rooted, right? Like, by the 14th century, we all forget French was still the language of court in England, because they were still French. The Normans conquered England in weeks in 1066, and they and their culture never left. But eventually the people of England went, oh yeah, it's just the king, right? It never stopped being Normans. It never stopped being French until another dynasty took over. Anyway, that was me waxing lyrical a little bit about sort of the way the Norman psychology may have worked. Again, I'm waxing lyrical about the psychology of people who died 1,000 years ago, but that's sort of the nature of history sometimes, isn't it? We don't know. I was always taught this at university. We don't know what people in the past thought unless they wrote it down. And they very rarely wrote it down until diaries became popular. So it's quite difficult to know, really, if William Ironarm was happy when he died in the 1040s with what he'd achieved, or if he felt that he had not done enough, if he hadn't lived up to the expectations of Tancred of Hauteville. I wonder how Robert the sixth son felt, 15 years later when he was crowned Duke by the Pope. I wonder if he was kneeling in St. Peter's Basilica thinking, wow, I bet my dad's proud of me. Or if he was thinking, right, now the work really starts. It's fascinating, isn't it? How all of that was happening in the 11th century and all of the other stuff in Europe and across the world was happening. Isn't the world a big place? Isn't its history huge and deep and wonderful and exciting, and everything's always happening all at the same time? Thank goodness they didn't have social media back then, or their brains would all have been overloaded like ours all are today. So, that's coming up on... Oh, it's over half an hour of me talking at you now, so I'm going to give you all a break from listening to my voice. I'm going to say, try and read the Ingoldsby Legends by Thomas Ingoldsby, wink, better known as Richard Harris Barham, if you want a light-hearted Victorian set of short stories. And they're good, they're readable, they're not like some of the... fairly chunky, fairly slow, fairly stodgy ones. I always find Dickens and Conan Doyle a little stodgy at times. But these seem to really rattle along. They're very, very short. They're only like 10 pages each. Give them a read if you're interested in them. I will write the name in the description. And yeah, enjoy a nice cup of tea. Have a relax. Don't forget to put the sun cream on. If it's as sunny where you are as it is where I am, you're going to need it. Water your seeds and seedlings. And unwaith eto, diolch yn fawr am wrando. Thank you very much for listening. And until the next time, tan y tro nesa, bye-bye for now. Hwyl am y tro. Steeped in History is presented by Jimmy Johnson. It is recorded by Jimmy Johnson, edited by Jimmy Johnson. Basically, I do all of this, but it does feature some lovely music by Inaban, and the logo and artwork is done by the wonderful Annika Benson. It is also hosted on the Audio Boom Network. Phew, I think that's it.